Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, everybody. I'm Marcus Speller, and welcome to the Barcelona Legacy Podcast. This is the fourth of a six-part series to coincide with the release of the Barcelona Legacy, a book that explores how the evolution of today's game begins at Barcelona 25 years ago with the pioneering ideas of Johan Cruyff and was taken on by the likes of Louis van Gaal, Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola. It's written by one of our panellists, Jonathan Wilson, who writes for The Guardian, Sports Illustrated and World Soccer, and it's out this month in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. We're also joined today by Miguel Delaney, who is the chief football writer at The Independent. So, Jonathan, in this podcast series, we're going to be looking at six matches that define this footballing evolution from Cruyff's Barcelona to Guardiola's Manchester City. This time we're looking at the Champions League final in 2009 between Barcelona and Manchester United. It's an obvious one, Jonathan, but why have we looked at this fixture?
I think this was the first time we really realised just how good a coach Guardiola was. And I think it was the first time we really realised just how Cruyff's philosophy could be applied in the modern age. So 4 years on from the last one we did, so 2005, the football we're looking at was still, we're still in that sort of post-Greece, post-year 2004 feeling of football's gone a bit more defensive, it's a bit more stringent, it's a bit more physical. Rijkaard, who was the losing coach of Barcelona in that last game, he wins the Champions League in 2006, and that's really the foundations for this Barcelona. You then have Ferguson's Manchester United wins the Champions League in 2008, beating Chelsea in the final. And so this is the defending champions against this new Barcelona side, who've been very fortunate to get by Chelsea in the semi-final. And I think most of us, certainly all three of us, who are all at the game, I think we all expected United to win. And within sort of a quarter of an hour, it was pretty obvious that wasn't going to happen. And actually, you're watching something pretty special.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, isn't it, how in football, these kind of things sort of hinge on moments. And of course, in the semi-final, they were lucky. Well, fortunate, certainly. Or some people described it as a disgrace, didn't they? but less said about that, the better, perhaps. But they were in the final. And I remember thinking, personally for me, despite Chelsea's efforts, this was a matchup between the two best sides in Europe. And you thought to yourself, Miguel, well, it's Ferguson's Manchester United. They're in a final. They know what they're doing. But as Jonathan said, was it 10 minutes, 12 minutes or something like that? When Barcelona scored after Manchester United's early running, it was all of them. And we just saw this Pep Guardiola team just suddenly take over the show. And that became the way they played football.
Yeah, this is it. And it feels like in that 10 minutes, this was the leap that the side made. Because I suppose one of the reasons why this match is so significant, beyond obviously winning the Champions League, it's not just that, it's also, had it just been a league and cup double in that first season, it would have been, okay, it's obviously been a good season for Guardiola. He's taken over what was an ailing Barca and he's restored a competitiveness to them. But to actually do a treble, that's the way it had a sort of deeper symbolism to it. But yeah, as I was going into the game, I think maybe it's because of that Chelsea match and the nature of it. And I mean, that was really a 50-50 game. They're quite lucky to get the decision. Or, well, in some decisions...
well, we should say what happened in that game. So Chelsea would tell you they've denied four clear penalties. I think if you look back at it,
they probably denied one and a half.
Yeah.
And then, even then, it takes a brilliant last-minute goal from Iniesta to win it.
It's Iniesta! 2 minutes from time, and it's heartbreaking
for Barcelona.
On away goal.
On away goals, yeah. It's certainly my thought was United will physically overpower Barca in the final, as Chelsea had actually looked like physically overpowering them in the semi.
That's, it was kind of a slightly softer Barca than 2 years later when they beat United. I mean, I suppose they still weren't fully formed in that way by then, and there were some kind of gaps in the lineup that maybe Guardiola actually rectified for that final.
Well, they also, I mean, let's not forget, they were without Dani Alves and Abidal through suspension.
Well, they played. So Silvinho played. Yeah.
He did, but Touré was centre-half, wasn't he?
Touré played centre-back and Puyol played right-back.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, so it was makeshift is perhaps too strong a word, but I suppose in the context of it, it was.
Well, you certainly looked at the back line, that matchup between Puyol against... I mean, I think we thought that Ronaldo might drift out to the side. As it turned out, Rooney played on that flank.
Mm.
But the thought of Ronaldo running at Puyol,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure that's going to make you sleep easy if you're a Barcelona fan.
I think there was one moment early on when Ronaldo did exactly that, didn't they? And then United got a free kick out of it.
And he hit one of those low scudding free kicks and Valdez sort of slightly, he didn't take it cleanly.
Looked a little bit nervy.
And then that first 10 minutes, it really looked like United would do what we thought they'd do and physically impose themselves. Guardiola had created this montage of great Barca moments from that season. Set it to the gladiator music because it was in Rome, so I guess it was a level of appropriateness, but incredibly sort of mawkish.
Yeah.
And players, you talk to players now about
this. This was in the dressing room before the game.
They were so moved by this, they were crying. And you wonder if almost a bit too emotionally hyped up.
Mm.
But then also there's a clever tactical switch that Barca started with Samueletto through the middle and Messi on the right. And after 10 minutes, they switched them over. So you've got Messi playing as a false nine. And almost immediately, Iniesta breaks down the right.
This is Iniesta, though. Oh, Eto's opened it up. Well, how about that for smash and grab? It's been all Manchester United, but after 9 minutes...
Ball through for Eto, who turns inside actually far too easily, and then a shot in the near post. Barca ahead. And after that, they barely lost the ball.
Do you think the switch was planned, actually, or was something he reacted to?
I think it was planned.
Yeah, because he had played Messi there for the 6-2 against, right? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm certain it was planned.
Mm. And in that game, then Iniesta and Xavi in particular just had a lovely old time, quite frankly. And they took the game by the scruff of the neck. And that, the words tiki-taka.
Yeah.
That's when, certainly in this country, we became a bit more aware of all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think we should explain that phrase as well, because Guardiola hates it.
Yeah. Right, okay.
So it's a word we used for that type of football. Mm. But actually, the word, as it was used in Spanish, was an insult. It's Javier Clemente, the very sort of tough Sam Allardyce figure. Is that too strong? Perhaps it is.
He played six defenders in his 94 team.
But he was...
Craig Levein, maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
He was the coach of Athletic, of Bilbao, in the 80s. Had this big rivalry with Barcelona. And that Athletic side were renowned, as many Athletic sides were, for playing quite direct, quite physical football, very British-influenced. And he was very sceptical of the pretty passing of Barcelona. So when he said tiki-taka, it was an insult. And so that's why Guardiola reacts quite badly to it. Mm. But I think the term is just used differently in Britain to Spain. So it's when we first kind of became aware of this thing we call tiki-taka, which he would call juego de posición.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that Xavi Iniesta, the carousel, as Ferguson called it the year beforehand, well, it didn't quite have the same effect. But I think when we realised that something different was happening, and I suppose it's central to everything Guardiola does, was I think it was about 10 minutes after the Eto goal in that game to give Barca the lead after 1 minute when Iniesta just cut through the middle and set Eto open. And Iniesta, who was told actually not to shoot before that game because of his leg muscle problems. But I think I remember I was in the overflow area because I was in a Sunday paper at the time, and we were quite high up in the stand. Remember, you could clearly see from about 20 minutes on, Carrick kept turning to the United bench, kind of going, what do I do? Because he'd been outmaneuvered. He had nowhere to go. And I suppose the roots of that, or why that happened, is maybe given Guardiola played as a player and the foundation of his philosophy is...
Yeah. And that's it, isn't it? When this Barcelona under Pep Guardiola got in full flow, teams just... It was like they were playing a different game and they kind of went on to create this kind of, I suppose, a global entity that is Barcelona now. But of course, Guardiola is Barcelona through and through, played there as a player under Cruyff, was pivotal in that dream team, Jonathan. So, when fans sing he's one of our own, I'm not sure if they do in Spain or not, quite frankly, but with him, it is absolutely the case.
Absolutely true. And in a sense, he's the second coming of Cruyff, that he's in the youth team. Cruyff gives him a debut. He's hopeless. Cruyff says, "My grandmother's faster than you," and forgets about him for 18 months. He's then desperate for a central midfielder. He's tried to sign Jan Molby, has been told he can't. And so he goes to the youth team to see what's there. And he's been told, "Oh, there's this kid, he's brilliant. You know, he's your man." And he's on the bench. And so Cruyff says, "Well, hang on, I want to see this kid. Why is he on the bench?" "Oh, he's too small." And Cruyff went mad. "You know, nobody's ever too small in my team. It's about how technically good you are." He promotes Guardiola, and within half a season, he's a regular at the back of midfield and absolutely essential to how they play. Physically, not big, not imposing, not quick, but incredible tactical brain and has all the technical skills, and becomes the motor of the team. You know, everything goes through him, and stays there. Right through the 90s, he's absolutely at the hub of the side. Leaves, but then the previous year, it had come back in 2006, had taken on the reserve side, had done very well there, and then gets the job ahead of Jose Mourinho after Rijkaard leaves.
It's fair to say Mourinho never got over that.
I think it is fair to say. So 2007-08, he came
in
for.
Sure, yeah.
And 2008, he gets the job. And 2008-09, he eventually has this brilliant season.
Mm-hmm. It's remarkable. I mean, Miguel, when we talk about scholars of the game, Pep Guardiola is one of them, and more so. Learning so much under Cruyff and so on and so forth, and developing ideas. The inside the mind of Guardiola is an intriguing thing.
Well, in between, I suppose, his retirement as a player and then when he went back to Barcelona, I mean, because of what Guardiola's done, it's almost, you see this a lot with other coaches who've just been players, and go, "Oh, he could be our Guardiola." We just because they're former players. But I think what obviously elevates Guardiola is that he didn't just have these ideas inherent, or that he kind of picked up for so long and had been really ingrained in him. In between his time after playing and then going back to Barca, he went on a world tour of a world educational tour of the game, and you know picked out people he admired, went to kind of go and study with them for a while.
Well, it's fascinating. He went for, he finished his career in Italy, and he goes to Mexico to play for a team called Dorados under Juan Marlillo, sort of this slight eccentric Spanish coach who has these very progressive ideas. And basically, that's his education. You know, he hasn't gone to Mexico because he really wants to play in the Mexican league. He's gone to learn under Leo.
Yeah.
And Leo's one of those coaches who I think is a great theorist, but struggled to put it into practice. And then before he starts the job, he goes to South America and he visits Ricardo La Volpe, who's another one of these great South American coaches, great ideas man. Results on the pitch, not necessarily great. Speaks to Cesar Luis Menotti, who, I mean, apart from winning the World Cup with Argentina, didn't really do very much in his career and had a pretty miserable time as Barcelona coach.
Mm-hmm.
And then the great Marcelo Bielsa. And there's a story of him, a seven-hour barbecue at Bielsa's house outside Rosario, where Guardiola's poor assistant is sort of made to practice man marking with a chair as they kind of discuss these theories and ideas. But Guardiola has gone to these great theorists, but then the beauty of what Guardiola does is he puts it into practice and it works. It's not a great theory. It's a great way to win football matches.
Yeah, but they didn't get off to a brilliant start, though, in his first season, Miguel, of course. Obviously, the way it panned out, I mean, it seemed to be everything that Guardiola touched turned to gold.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the case early on.
No, they didn't. It took them three matches to win a game, win a competitive game.
It was a long time for Barcelona.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose there's even more to it than that, because it's not just that he'd taken over a side. It looked like they were having another one of what throughout Barcelona's history has been a periodic massive crisis. Because, it had been 2 years since they won the Champions League under Rijkaard. They won that in 2006, obviously. It's 2008. And it just looked, everything about the club looked somehow, it was amazing how quickly it unraveled.
There's a decadence there.
Yeah.
And I think it begins actually immediately they win the Champions League. That their preparations for the Super Cup, stories about Rijkaard hanging out with this Dutch pop group and, Ronaldinho on the day of the game going off to do a photo shoot. So there's a lot of problems there with personnel. The first thing Guardiola does when he gets there is say, right, I'm going to get rid of Ronaldinho, Deco and Eto. I don't trust any of them. As it turned out, Eto persuaded him to give him another season. But Guardiola was ruthless. And it's the people who think, oh, you know, anybody could have won it with that group of players. Well, he actually selected a group of players by getting rid of the deadwood, the people who were over the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he promoted Busquets and Pedro, who he'd had in the youth team. So he knew exactly what they were. I mean, Busquets is probably as close to a player as you would get to Guardiola. I'm not sure mentally he's quite as sophisticated, quite as, you know, I don't think he sees the game necessarily quite as well as Guardiola did. In terms of a style of player, you look at him, you say physically, yeah, what is he? Why is that a good footballer? Yeah, you look at what he does on the pitch, it's quite hard to explain. But his positional sense, his ability to be in the right place at the right time, to play the simple pass to the right person at the right time, was absolutely critical to how Barcelona
played. Quickly he moves his feet as well.
That's
something I mean you kind of heard about in Guardiola's first season at City, actually, that he didn't quite have that pivot in the same way.
And that was actually, it was speed of foot that was why he got rid of Joe Hart, even.
He
needs his goalkeeper to do that. So on that disappointing start, you know, they lose 1-0 to Numancia, having dominated the game, hit the woodwork twice. They then draw against Racing Santander. They lose Sant Andreu in the Copa de Catalunya. Okay, much changed team. But he's actually booed. Like, the fans who go to see this game on an artificial pitch in the north of Barcelona boo him.
Mm.
And Guardiola's sort of in this panic because if he loses the next game against Racing Santander, he could be the first coach ever to take Barcelona to the bottom of La Liga. And so he goes to see Johan Cruyff, his great mentor. Cruyff, who has no official position at the club, but he's sort of this power behind the throne. He's the one who is pulling all the strings. He has a very influential column in El Periodico. And Cruyff says to Guardiola, no, keep going, this is fine, the results will come, and writes a column to say, this is the best Barcelona I've ever seen. This is 1.2 games and out of the Copa de Catalunya.
It's remarkable.
I'm actually trying to think of a cultural analogy for what Cruyff was at that point.
Alistair Campbell?
He's
Richelieu, isn't he? He's the Eminence Grise. He's the power that makes everything happen, but has no... I mean, that was what Cruyff did. You know, he stopped being a coach age 49 and remained the most powerful powerful person in football for another 20 years.
Yeah. But the endorsement of Guardiola
was
important in the wider context, of course, as it proved to be, but also very important for Guardiola himself. Because
actually it happened with the reserve team as well. Guardiola had some problems with discipline in the first couple of weeks, and he went to see Cruyff and said, what do I do about this? And Cruyff said, get rid of them, bin them.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter who they are, bin them. Make sure you do it your way. And he did that. So I think Cruyff was quite important in giving Guardiola sort of self-confidence and self-belief to do it his way.
Even in terms of the mentality, there was also the kind of the very tangible physical effects. I mean, I remember at the time that Guardiola had some rule about all the players to be a certain weight for their size, and he felt a lot of them were kind of almost 2 kilos overweight. And it was at the same time, almost kind of someone that's become, you know, personification of all this was Messi, who for 3 previous seasons, I don't think he got a single season without a long-term injury until Guardiola got his hands on him, gave him a specific regime, cut out certain things from his diet, or instructed him to cut out certain things from his diet. Not that Messi always did that. And then suddenly, Messi himself enjoyed this explosion.
Well, actually, I think Messi did do that under Guardiola.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he's gone back on the Sprite and the Milanesas, which maybe is why he's, certainly the last World Cup, why he looked a bit under Guardiola, I mean, Guardiola's tough. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
He's this great intellect, this great theorist, but he's tough. He doesn't let players get away with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also critical to it. And it's also, I think, why players, I think we saw that at Barcelona, we certainly saw that at Bayern, players get a bit tired of him.
Yeah.
And I think, actually, even as a player, there's an element of that Laurent Blanc said, it was almost like Yap Sam's description of the Nevilles, that he was always there, always yabbering away.
Busy.
And he was just busy. Yeah, quite. Busy in the Yap-Sam sense of a term.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
But do you think that he would have learnt that from Cruyff, the managerial style? You know, you hear about other coaches, you know, have influenced almost the personality of their coaching. You could argue maybe someone like Martin O'Neill and Brian Clough or something like that. But perhaps a better example might be with the way Guardiola approaches things that Cruyff did.
Yeah, and I think you see elements both of Cruyff and less obviously Van Gaal. Guardiola's definitely his formation in the game, both in terms of growing up at La Masia at Barcelona's academy, which was founded by Cruyff. So growing up in that style, getting, you know, having those principles instilled in him, his whole education in the game is a Cruyffian education, and then playing under Cruyff and becoming Cruyff's sort of mouthpiece on the pitch. Of course, you know, intellectually, philosophically, in terms of his belief that position is the most important thing. All of that he takes from Cruyff, but I think he also takes a lot from Van Gaal, and I think he himself has said that Van Gaal, in terms of direct influence, was the most influential coach he ever had.
Mm. And with going back to the final itself, the way Barcelona set up or the way they played throughout that season, I suppose how kind of traditionally Barcelona or Cruyffian was it then, Miguel? You know, we saw a lot of pressing, we saw the attacking football, the three up front, all that kind of stuff. And it was almost a continuation of Rijkaard, as we said.
But taken on another level, I think. This is it. It just felt like, basically, it was the core Cruyff principles, but just significantly updated for the modern age. It's worth it, in relation to what Jonathan was saying earlier about that era of football, I think even Ferguson's United representatives, given which was a departure from what they'd previously been, but this is an area where when it felt like defences are back on top, where it was all about physical power was key, you know, as Greece made clear in 2004, Italy to a certain extent 2006, and then even United had got back to winning the Champions League through a very strong defence and counter-attacking, whereas suddenly here was a team that was just was willing to step forward in that way. I remember talking actually to people who work in youth coaching after, about a few years after this, and that season with Spain winning the 2008 or Euro 2008, but then really what Guardiola did taking on from that, or sorry, I suppose it was, I mean the two were connected, but Guardiola still took it on a level. It was a different team, but with some of the same players. But I mean, it's something now that I think we probably take for granted, but at that time, the key skill for your defender still wasn't his ability to take the ball out of defence, whereas Guardiola's changed, and it's permeated right through every single level of the game. And we see it in how modern players are produced, but where the key requirement for a centre-back now is comfort on the ball.
Mm. And a full-back has to be able to get forward down the line, he has to be able to cross the ball. And you know, who was United's right-back that day? John O'Shea.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. I mean, okay, you can say that Barca had Puyol, but ideally he'd have been in the centre and they'd had Dani Alves there. You're contrasting Dani Alves to John O'Shea, they're different types of player. Maybe
yeah. Yeah, there's an Irishman in the room, we'll say they're different types of player.
I'm a Sunderland fan. But.
Yeah, true enough. But it's true, isn't it? And as Miguel said, that he took that kind of Cruyffian stuff to the next level. And Barcelona, certainly Spain, but Barcelona almost became like the sort of unofficial home of football in the next sort of few years. But that season, though, you can't understate how impactful it has been through football, through even to grassroots level. I mean, even to the kind of level of football that, you know, I've played, you see teams don't just lump it forward. Yeah. That passing and so on, the influence has been utterly remarkable.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Mm. And you know, we've had the discussion recently about this Real Madrid winning 4 out of the last 5 Champions Leagues. Are they a great team? And I think we both feel quite resistant to that idea because they haven't changed the game. They've been very efficient at the accumulation of silverware, but this Barcelona changed how we saw the game. Mm-hmm. There's sort of scales from the eyes moment.
Yeah,
And I think almost, I almost feel it happened to myself midway through that second half. Go, I did not think this was possible. This is incredible. A game of this level is not tight. It's not about not making a mistake. It's about just having the ball and the opposition cannot get off you. I think you saw United panic in this game. And the point Miguel was making about Carrick turning to the bench saying, what do we do? Because a team like Manchester United was not used to having 40%, 35% possession. That seemed an enormous humiliation. We're Manchester United, we have the ball.
Mm.
And maybe in certain games we'll accept having 40, 45%. But we're still basically in control. The idea that you couldn't get the ball, that was completely alien. Now, what's changed is we're now used to seeing 70-30 splits of possession. And we're actually pretty comfortable with it.
Mm.
And we don't necessarily think the team with 70% will win. But this was something unique.
Yeah. Without dwelling on Mourinho again as well, but I think it pointed to a significant difference between Guardiola and Mourinho and this split in kind of the historical evolution of the game in terms of, you know, Mourinho had become the most prominent, probably best manager in the world through a certain style, which is based on ultimately safety first, security, and, you know, the physical protection. And to a certain degree, a lack of faith in technical ability, whereas Guardiola was all about ultimate faith in technical ability. It was trust, trust and a kind of confidence in expression.
Yeah,
and facilitating that through engendering in players an understanding of position on the pitch, so that when a man had the ball, he had minimum two passes in front of him and one pass behind him. So, you know, Guardiola's whole system, his whole juego de posición, as he would call it, the positional game, we might call it, translated. You know, he divides the pitch into 20 zones. I mean, it's not as simple as 4x5. You know, some of the zones are different sizes, but essentially it's 20 zones. And in a horizontal zone, no more. Yeah, you know, if three are filled, that's too many. And in a vertical zone, if four are filled, that's too many. And the idea is, if if you're not in a straight line, you're creating angles, so the passing option is always there.
Mm-hmm.
And you should never have more than one player, when you have a ball, you should never have more than one player in a zone at any one time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The oddity of all that, actually, is I was thinking of this watching City this season, and to a certain degree, even Bayern Munich under Guardiola 3 years ago, even that 2009 final looks slightly... It lacks sophistication compared to how he would develop the team in 2011 at Bayern and then with City.
It was his first season, Mikel.
Yeah, of course. I suppose that's the point. That itself represented such a leap and that there was still more... Because I remember when you see Xavier Iniesta on the ball in that final, he was still relatively fixed.
Mm.
Whereas now with his kind of modern Bayern or City teams, it always feels like one player has the ball in the centre. There's almost kind of this... four players around them at all times, always rotating. They're always in motion, these kind of endlessly spinning wheels.
I think that point about lack of sophistication comparative to now is it's even more evident if you look at Spain in 2008.
Mm.
At the time, we were watching that going, this is an amazing team. I can't believe a team of this technical quality is able, coming straight after Greece
in
winning the Euros and after Italy winning the World Cup. There was something incredible about Spain. Look at them now.
Mm.
And the football actually looks really basic and really ordinary. And that's the extent to which Guardiola's ideas have permeated and have changed what we expect from top teams.
And one of the things this Barcelona side did in that season, and obviously would go on to do quite naturally, is the pressing. And it's interesting because Samuel Eto'o, of course, nearly left, didn't he? And as you say, managed to persuade him. Yeah, Eto'o was one of those forwards who
absolutely
would press.
And
it was remarkable to think that if Eto'o had left, you know, what would have happened and all that kind of stuff.
Guardiola's issue with Eto'o, I think, was less to do with a sort of a desire or a kind of willingness to work on the pitch. It's Eto'o was very critical of teammates. There was a player that season who, his wife had just had a child and the child was very ill. And so he was spending a lot of time in the hospital and often wasn't going to bed, was in the hospital overnight. And Eto'o was hammering him in training, kind of, what are you doing? You're not running. Well, the reason he wasn't running was because he hadn't slept for 36 hours.
Mm.
And Guardiola was, was happy this guy was turning up for training. And he kept saying to Eto'o, come on, I'll do the discipline, you do the playing. And Eto'o kept going at him. So that was why Guardiola and Eto'o, why there was a tension there. It wasn't to do with style of play, it wasn't to do with application on the pitch, it was to do with the personality issue off the pitch.
Sure, but on the pitch, that pressing that Eto'o would lead from the front was crucial to that side and that Cruyffian principle
as well. We think of Guardiola and we think of his football as being about possession, and obviously to a large degree it is. But when he gave his first seminar to the European Coaching Convention, it was about getting the ball back.
Yeah.
Because you can't have the ball if you haven't got the ball. You've got to get the ball to have the ball.
That's right, yeah.
And so, yeah, that organised pressing to win the ball back, and this idea that you should try and win the ball back within 3 seconds, mm-hmm. And that the opponent is its most vulnerable in that 3 seconds having won the ball back. Yeah, so I win the ball off you, and I've exerted physical effort to get the ball, and my head's down because I've been winning the ball, and maybe players have moved since I last looked up. That's when I'm vulnerable. That's when you've got to get the ball back. And if you don't get the ball back in 3 seconds, then you sit off and you resume your normal defensive shape. But instilling that 3 second rule is very, very difficult. I mean, Peter Bosch, when he was at Ajax, made it a 5 second rule. Guardiola's 3 seconds. It had to be that quick. So winning the ball back is absolutely crucial to his philosophy.
Mm. And as you said, Miguel, Carrick and the boys that night certainly didn't manage to win the ball back very often. Do you think that was because Manchester United, they didn't have the team or experience to deal with Guardiola? And I suppose in subsequent years, against Guardiola sides, very few people seem to be able to deal with it at all, because it's just such an effective way. It's you don't have a plan B, the plan A is so flipping good.
That was basically it was a new challenge that Ferguson and a lot of other managers hadn't figured out. And it was actually interesting too. I remember actually after that final, there was this, and it was particularly played up in the build up to the 2011 final, where Ferguson, some of the United players mentioned it, where Ferguson kind of said, "Oh, Ferguson knew what he did wrong in that 2009 final, and he was going to rectify it for 2011."
He didn't really.
I know, exactly. He felt like they played the same sort of way.
Yeah, which was remarkable, really.
Well, I think the mistake he made that he subsequently acknowledged was taking off Anderson at halftime for Tevez.
Yeah.
So he basically went to effectively a 4-2-4.
Yeah.
But that just surrendered the midfield.
Mm.
But you know, you look at that midfield and Carrick, Giggs, Anderson, it's not that mobile. Mm. It's not really surprising that a deaf team can pass the way around them. So, and I guess there's two ways of playing against Barca. You either push right up, get in their faces and press them high up the pitch, or you sit back and let them have the ball. And the problem was, teams hadn't worked this out at that point. And so United were caught in this halfway house. And I think this went on for sort of two or 3 years, teams didn't work this out, that you had to do one or the other. And getting in their faces was incredibly risky because you risk leaving space behind you. But sitting back was incredibly risky because they have 70% possession. They're going to have.
They'll eventually get their moment.
And like you're hoping none of those 15 shots fly in the top corner.
Yeah, that's right.
But getting caught between the two stools, I think, is what happened to United both in 2009 and 2011. There is no chance.
But the one difference between the two finals, actually, in 2009, I think United were just completely outmaneuvered. Whereas in 2011, they're both outmaneuvered and overpowered. Because remember, at about 65 minutes in the 2011 final, Tony Valencia was probably one of the fittest players in the Premier League, if not Europe. And he was trying to, I think it might have been, I can't remember exactly who it was, but basically trying to track a Barcelona player. He just fell into the back of them. And it was, you know, it was such visible evidence of a player exhausted.
Yeah. I mean, certainly Barcelona that night in Rome were just so dominant. And this was the Barcelona side. This was the team that we, so many people around the world loved this side. Because as you say, Miguel, it was different from the way Mourinho had done things. They attacked with flair. They were exciting to watch. They scored tons of goals. And so on and so forth. It was never boring watching them. And I think a lot of people would set time aside to watch this side, which was, I suppose, would you say, Jonathan, that's part of the sort of the Cruyffian legacy to make attractive, play attractive football and entertain people?
I mean, that's certainly what Cruyff would say.
Yeah, I've no doubt he would say that, yeah.
I mean,
or perhaps a byproduct of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a useful byproduct, useful stick to beat opponents with when they don't play that way.
But because it came almost like a right and wrong way of playing.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a sense that Cruyff introduced a moral sensitivity to football.
Yes.
A sense that we are the good people playing right way. We are progressive. This other way is sort of reductive and negative. That quickly, and actually, to be fair to Cruyff, that was probably always true of his teams, which is why they lived on the edge so often. You know, although they won the four titles in a row, two of them won on the last day of the season in very fortuitous circumstances, and it's why they were so brittle and vulnerable, you know, as we discussed in episode two.
Mm-hmm.
Guardiola, I think they were a little bit cannier, but they didn't really need to be canny because he was just so much better.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I mean, looking back at Cruyff the player, if you think of the 73 European Cup final when they just held the ball, they took the lead after 4 minutes against Juventus and passed the ball around, Juventus couldn't get it back. Yeah. That was sort of the sterile possession that Spain maybe were guilty of in 2010. So it's a fine line, but I think you can say of Cruyff's teams, and perhaps for slightly different reasons, Guardiola's teams, there was always that impetus to attack. There was never that negativity, that sterility.
On that though, actually, I was just before the Champions League final this year in Kiev, with all the talk about Real's three in a row, I was looking back to previous threes in a row and an interview with Johnny Rep about that final against Juventus. And he kind of starts going on, we always felt the criticism was very unfair because the problem with that final was basically just, it was so easy for us. It was just such an easy game. That even at 1-0, they knew that there was nothing Juventus
could... But there was an element of making a point as well.
Yeah,
the Juventus were famous for sort of their Catenaccio, for very defensive football. And Ajax basically went, okay, get the ball, come out. Oh, you're not going to? All right, we'll just pass it around then. And it was Rep who got the goal, wasn't it, after 4 minutes?
Yeah. Actually, even in terms of the second goal of that game, which is probably Messi's real elevation into what I mean, because it was, I mean, I suppose as we discussed earlier, everyone knew Messi's talent, but because he'd been so injured for so long in his previous 3 years, I mean, Ronaldo had just been, you know, Ballon d'Or winner, there was still a sense that Messi was discovering his true level, whereas that was probably a leap, and there was a bit of historical symbolism, a parallel there too, because he got a header in that game, which is something that he'd been criticised for. And that was the exact same as 72, which is probably that Ajax's team's peak moment and Cruyff's peak as a player, in which he also got a header, a lack of quality he'd been criticised for.
Yeah, I mean, that Messi header, it's an incredible header as well. It's a great cross from Xavi.
It's 2-0. It's Messi. He's scored against an English club now. It's Manchester United at a crucial, crucial time with 20 minutes to go.
But it's a proper sort of English number 9 header.
Yeah.
It's so powerful, his boot falls off. The sort of shockwave through his muscles makes his boot fall off.
Yeah.
And that was 20 minutes to go. And I mean, that even if he hadn't scored it, we knew the game was over.
Yeah, exactly.
But that was absolutely rubber stamped.
But even by that point, and as you said, United went to 4-2-4, but they just couldn't get into the game. They couldn't get it to their forwards at all. I think Ronaldo was doing his typical kind of, you know, gesticulating everywhere at hand because he was so frustrated.
Mm. One of the most dominant performances in a Champions League final, certainly.
And actually not as dominant as 2011.
Exactly.
But I mean, I remember we left the ground together in Rome. We had a walk for, I don't know, about an hour and a half looking for a taxi. And I just remember kind of that 90-minute walk.
Yeah.
Kind of basically the entire conversation was, God, they were good. Yeah. Like, how good was that?
Yeah.
What have we just seen?
Yeah. Well, I my friend and I, we organised to get home on... with sort of Manchester United fans, even though we were neutrals. And we got on the bus and we looked round at them all and went, God, that was quite... you're still upset about that. Yeah, sorry about that.
there was a lingering thing, though, basically until 2011, that final might have been a bit of a freak. Do you remember all that discussion for 2 years, like, oh, Spain's an easy league, you know, they can't defend properly, they're vulnerable, until basically 2011 really hammered the
still
point.
Still saying that now, they've won 9 of the last 10.
Yeah.
We're still not convinced. But we're convinced of Cruyff's legacy, certainly. So we'll leave it there. But thank you very much for listening, everybody. That was the fourth of a six-part series to coincide with the release of the Barcelona Legacy, a book that explores how the evolution of today's game begins at Barcelona 25 years ago with the pioneering ideas of Johan Cruyff and was taken on by the likes of Louis van Gaal, Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola, of course, written by our panellist Jonathan Wilson. Jonathan, thank you for joining us once again. And Miguel Delaney, of course, the chief football writer at The Independent. Thank you, Miguel.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.